The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Epic of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish history based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKollel, Dean of the Kollel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America. This lecture, titled The Humble Patriarch, is the eighth of a 12-part series from the fall of Betar to the completion of the Mishnah. This lecture was originally given at Machon LaTorah, the Jewish Learning Network of Michigan, and is dedicated to the memory and the Ilui Nishmas Tovia ben Avraham Olav HaSholem, Tolik Ferber of blessed memory.
One of the most unique families in Jewish history is the family of the famous Nasi HaSanhedrin, the patriarch of the Sanhedrin, Hillel. Rarely in Jewish life do we find generation after generation of Gedolim, men of great spiritual and intellectual stature, as we do with the family of Hillel. Starting with Hillel, who became Nasi, the patriarch, in the year 31 before the Common Era, at the age of 80, and continuing with his son Shimon, Shimon's son Gamliel the First, Gamliel's son Shimon, Shimon's son Gamliel the Second, and again Gamliel's son Shimon. By the time of Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel the Second's death, in approximately the year 69, we have six generations, almost 200 years, of inspired leadership provided by Hillel and his descendants. Some 200 years after the death of Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel II, descendants of his were still following in his footsteps in the position of patriarch, of Nasi. The calendar that we use today is the work of Hillel II, patriarch of the Sanhedrin, and the 13th generation of the original founder of the dynasty of Hillel. That was approximately the year 359 of the Common Era. So we have almost 400 years from the first Hillel, when he began, to the reign of the second Hillel. What special trait did Hillel possess that he should merit such a place for himself and his progeny? Amongst the various facets of a stellar personality, one special attribute of his stood out: his humility and patience. Although we've already recounted the story of Hillel in previous lecture, this particular story bears repeating. It once happened, this is taken from a Gemara in Shabbos and Lamed Aleph Amud Aleph in 31a, the two men made a wager with each other. They bet each other the one who's going to make Hillel angry will receive 400 zuz. In other words, they put 400 zuz in the kitty. And this is the one who's going to, this is the wager, the one who's going to make Hillel, he's going to take everything. So the first one said, okay, I'll try it first. It was Erev Shabbos. It was Sabbath Eve. It was right before Shabbos. Hillel was preparing for Shabbos. He was washing his head. So he went, and Hillel already was, he was the Nasi of the Sanhedrin. He was the patriarch. He was over 80 at the time. What the age is, we don't have clearly, because Hillel was, the Nasi was a patriarch for 40 years. But he was a man well into his years already. He was above 80. And he was washing his hair. And the person called out, you know, is Hillel here? Is Hillel here? In other words, hey, is Hillel? You know, he's knocking on the door. Where is Hillel? So Hillel got dressed, put on his robe, and went out. And he says, my son, what do you want? I have an important question to ask. He says, ask, my son. Why are the heads of the Babylonians round? Why are they shape? This is the era of Shabbos, you know. Anyone who's familiar with how a household goes right before Shabbos is coming in, especially when they're taking showers and there's a line, you know. And he says, so Hillel answered, my son, you've asked a great question. It's because the midwives are not skilled. In other words, the head is misshapen when it comes out of the birth canal. They're not skilled. Well, he left, evidently very disappointed. He wasn't able to make Hillel angry. Evidently, Hillel went back to washing his hair. He comes back. Evidently, he had timed it. He figured what's the time for him to go back to what he's doing. He knocks again on the door. Hey, where is Hillel? You know, he's knocking on the door. So he comes in. He says, my son, what do you want? He says, why are the eyes of the Palmyrians? Palmyra was a city in Syria at one time. It was the seat of a great empire. This is Talmud, and the Talmud says, why are their eyes, you know, they have bleary eyes. I mean, their eyes are, there's something problem. They have eye problems. Somebody else has asked an ophthalmologist, Reminishkin Kop, it's Erev Shabbos, you know what I mean? What are you asking? He says, you've asked a very good question, my son. Because they live in sandy places. As the sand gets into the eye. It's a question in the commentaries whether they suffer from the eye problem or the shape of their eye is different than in other places. Again, evidently he gave time, he left. Evidently he gave Hillel enough time to start again to wash his hair. You know? And again he goes back and he knocks on the door. He says, where is Hillel here? You know, and he says, again he knocks, you can imagine the sight. Again he gets dressed. He says, my son, what does he ask? He says, I have a question to ask. He says, ask my son. He says, what are the feet of the Africans wide? They have larger feet. You have to realize again, this is Erev Shabbos. It's right before Shabbos. He says, my son, you've asked a great question. He says, because they're referring to, they live in marshy, watery marshes, and it's important for them to have wide feet for balance. So he wasn't, the one who was asking wasn't feeling too good. He says, I have a lot of questions to ask, Rabbi. He says, but I'm afraid you'll get angry at me. Don't worry, you can ask as much as you want. He says, are you really Hillel? He says, you know, who's called the Nossi, the patriarch? Yeah, that's me. So he says, well, I hope there are not many people like you around. He says, why? Because you, I lost 400 zoos. You know, he says, be careful of your temper, he said. He says, Hillel is worth it. He says, you should lose 400 and again 400. He says, like this. He says, but it's worth to lose all that money. He says, but Hillel shouldn't get angry. And the Talmud quotes this as a, to give you an insight of what kind of a person Hillel was. The attribute, the midah of humility, is not merely, this is one facet of the entire spectrum of one's personality, but rather one of the most crucial, if not the most crucial aspect of one's character. According to the opinion of Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, recorded in the Gemara in Avodah Zorah in Chof Amud Beis in 20b, humility is the greatest of all character traits and the one that enables a person to reach the highest level, the level of Ruach HaKodesh, the level of prophecy. Just like his illustrious forebearer, Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, the great-great grandson of Hillel, displayed an unusually high degree of humility. In fact, in a certain sense, he showed even greater humility than Hillel himself. But humility, like every other aspect of personality, has to be balanced and applied appropriately. A Nossi, a patriarch of the Sanhedrin, the highest position in the highest judicial and legislative body and jury, often has to shed the cloak of humility and demand respect and honor. not necessarily for himself, but rather for his position and all that it symbolizes. The art of that balance and its impact on history is the subject of tonight's lecture. Before we begin, though, I would like to go over some of the early history of the position of the Nasi, the Patriarch of the Sanhedrin, that which we went over in the first year of the lectures, to give you a sense of what was involved here, what is involved being the head of the Sanhedrin, what responsibilities does it entail, what's involved. The Torah describes in Parshas Baloscha of Moshe, who originally had the position of the he embodied as one individual the equivalent of the highest judicial body, transferring that position to a group of 70 elders, and those 70 elders became the Sanhedrin. It was the highest Jewish court. There is a question, what was Moshe's position after the creation of this body of 70 elders? Rabbi Yehuda maintained, and Rabbi Yehuda was the subject of the last lecture, that Moshe's was in an advisory capacity. The Sanhedrin consisted of 70. There was the mufla, there was the expert, that was a non-voting member, but he was there for all discussion. So his was of the highest counsel to the Sanhedrin. The Chachamim, the others, his colleagues, the majority opinion, which is the opinion that the Rambam Maimonides quotes, is that Moshe was a voting member. In other words, so he wasn't there just as an advisory capacity. He was a voting member of the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin therefore consisted of 71 voting members. Because both opinions agree there are 71, but that one, what is that? Is that a voting member, or is it just an advisory? He's just an advisory position. He has to be there for all discussion, but he does not vote. That's the question. But the position of Sanhedrin is defined basically in two, dealing with two aspects. One, judicial, similar to our Supreme Court, where all questions that were unresolved from the lower courts came to this court. In a sense, it also had the power to deal with special cases, a capital punishment regarding a prophet or a high priest. There were special cases that the Sanhedrin tried on their own. So there were a trial court as well, not just not in terms of an appeal. In other words, it didn't have the function of our Supreme Court, that one would overturn a previous decision, but rather it would be the court where the final questions that were unresolved would be brought to this, to this highest court. So its function was judicial in terms of the highest, most expert body, and also there were special cases that were only to be judged by the Sanhedrin. That's its judicial capacity. It also had a legislative capacity. We know that there are many laws which are part of Jewish practice today that are rabbinical. The Rambam maintains, Maimonides' opinion, that rabbinic legislation that comes from the highest court, has a quasi-Torah power to it. Just as one is not allowed to rule contrary to the final decisions of the High Court, one cannot summarily says, dismiss their legislation and not follow it. So once the High Court has issued a ruling in terms of new legislation to protect the Torah, it's basically, for the most part, legislation that we're dealing with is to protect the Torah. Some of it is in the spirit of the Torah, like Hanukkah. But its source, the observance of Hanukkah, also came from the highest, would we be the highest legislative body. So Sanhedrin, therefore, had in it what we have today's three parts in our system, an executive, judicial, and legislative. So there, the judicial and legislative powers were all put into one body. So they, most of what we know as dinim derabbanan, as rabbinic law, came originally from the Sanhedrin, from the highest court. However, the executive branch, and as we've dealt with the judicial branch, the legislative branch, which were both in the Sanhedrin, the executive branch originally was to be in the hands of the melech, the king. We had, in the early history, we had the shoftim, the judges. And it's not clear what their status was. Were they judges? Did they work in conjunction, again, with the high court? Or they were just called judges, but basically they were an independent executive body. And it's not clear. Very little remains of the history of that period. But definitely when we had the time of the kings were on their own an executive body. And they had the right to issue, what seems from the commentaries, to issue laws or to abrogate laws as need be for the good of the kingdom. A king could, if he felt right, could punish offenders, even though the punishment was not warranted by the Torah itself. This is executive privilege, not the Nixonian executive privilege. This is the right of kings. So we have the political body. And those who's taking care of the political needs and representing the state in the position of king, of melech. After the Jews were conquered, and basically they no longer had an executive branch. They could still have a legislative branch and a judicial branch. But an executive branch, they were a captive people. But they were given a certain level of independence by the conquering kings. And we find that what would be the equivalent of an executive branch, those powers were in the hands of the Kohen Gadol, the high priest. The original position of high priest, of course, is a religious position, not a political position. But in the time, it seems definitely in the time of the Greeks and most probably in the time of the Persians, the high priest already had powers well beyond the power the Torah itself gave. And it became a political position, and it became the equivalent of an executive position. During the time of the Greeks, this was in the time of Ptolemy III, this is approximately the year 225 before the Common Era, thereabouts, there grew a large group, it would seem, at least a powerful group of Jews that gained their power from the Egyptian Greeks, and as the Greeks who had conquered Egypt were in power over Egypt, who taxed that whole area that was under their domain. And that taxation, the power of taxation, was given over to a Jew, Yosef ben Tovia. He shared that power, of course, with his cohorts. And they plundered that area. In other words, it wasn't a job of a tax collector. Taxes were bid to the highest bidder. The ones who won the right of taxing had to give the government that amount. They, of course, taxed the people above the amount. The difference was their profit margin. This Yosef ben Tovia was given troops by Ptolemy, by the Egyptian king, to enforce his power. When he first came to Gaza, when he got the position and he had outbid the other bidders, and of course he charged, the taxes were exorbitant, and the people, the members of the Gazan community, I believe they were Jews, the members of the Gazan community were outraged and refused to pay those high taxes. He took the I believe it was 20 of the most prestigious citizens of Gaza and had them killed. Afterwards, there was no problem paying taxes. And during the time when the Egyptians were in control of Palestine, he became very wealthy, he and his group of people. Unscrupulous people, it seems from sources at least that they were not, could be in public amongst Jews, they acted as Jews, but outside of the area when there was peer pressure, they were quite assimilated. These people eventually, by the way, became being the core of those Jews that prevailed upon Antiochus, the villain of the Hanukkah story, to enforce these laws of forced assimilation. And it was really because of them that the whole Hanukkah story occurred, these assimilated Jews. And this, Antiochus did not do this unilaterally. He did it at the request of these assimilated Jews. In fact, after many reversals in the battlefield, one of the successors of Antiochus had the so-called high priest, who was an assimilated Jew who took that position, had him killed, because it was only at his urging that the Syrians, the Greeks, got involved with the Jews. So he felt he was the one who caused them all the tsoros, so he had him eliminated. I mean, it was clear, this is a passage Josephus quotes. I mean, it was clear that the Greeks came at the behest of these assimilated Jews. At the time when these assimilated Jews were growing in power, the position of the high priest, which previously had become the emissary, had become he was the one who collected taxes before on behalf of the Greeks. He was the go-between between the dominant government and the Jews. His position was stripped, and he basically had just the ceremonial position of high priest. The Egyptians, who had put in this tax collector and their group, suffered reversals in the battlefield. And their neighbors to the north, also Syrian Greeks, they're both basically the rulers were related to each other. I mean, they were Greeks. The Syrian Greeks eventually conquered Palestine, and Palestine became part of the Syrian Empire. During that time, there was a vacuum of leadership. The Sanhedrin, up until now, was only a judicial and legislative body, not an executive body. The Kohen Gadol, the high priest, who up until this time originally was given this executive power, during the time of these tax collectors, Yosef ben Tovia and his group, lost all those powers. And it was important for the Sanhedrin, in this time of political vacuum, to take the initiative. This is around the year 200 before the Common Era, thereabouts. And when we find that Antiochus III, the father of the villain of the Hanukkah story, came into Yerushalayim, this is the victorious king, as he had come in over the Egyptians, he was greeted by the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin at that point had taken the initiative to deal directly with the king. And it's according to the historian Rav Isaac HaLevi, it's at that time do we find a new position created in the Sanhedrin, of Nossi, of prince. The name Nossi, prince, has always been a political position. The princes of the tribes were leaders of the tribes. It was a political position. And now we find the creation of a political position in the Sanhedrin. And this is why we first find the idea of pairs, the zugos. Yossi ben Yoezer and Yossi ben Yochanan are the two first pairs. One is the Nossi, which is the highest position, and the lower position is Av Beis Din. This is the leader, the head of the Beis Din. However, Isaac HaLevi understands that this new exalted position was created, that the Nossi, as head of the Sanhedrin, had a dual role. It was inside and outside. He was still the highest position in the Sanhedrin, but he also had to deal with issues of state and social issues. We find the Sanhedrin as a statement of the Gemara in Lamed Zayin Amud Aleph and Gittin. Rabban Gamliel, this is the father of the subject of tonight's lecture, is Avian Shel Yisomim, the father of the orphans. He was the one, this is, took care of the social needs of the orphans. That's what today is that the welfare state takes care of. This is what they're trying to get rid of now, with the block grants to the states. But what the welfare state took up is, ultimately, we would say that President Clinton is the father of all the those who are on, with mothers with dependent children. Of all the, so too, says one could say, Rabban Gamliel was Avien Shel Yisomim. He was the father, he was the take care of all of the Yisomim, all of the orphans. He was involved in political and social issues, which normally in the time of a king would take care of. That this falls under the executive branch. But already at this time, there was created a position that was not only the highest position in the Sanhedrin, but also had position vis-a-vis the outside world. And because he was not totally involved now in the Sanhedrin, it was important to have somebody else in the Sanhedrin below him that would be totally involved. So the highest position still had involvement in the Sanhedrin, but since it was divided to needs outside, there was somebody who was totally in the Sanhedrin. That secondary position was Av Beis Din, the head. This was the name of the position. And according to Rav Isaac HaLevi, it was at this juncture of history, this is the 200 before the Common Era, when the power of Palestine was wrested from the Egyptian Greeks over to the Syrian Greeks, and there was this vacuum of power because the high priest no longer had the executive position. It was important that people of stature take care of the needs of the community. The Sanhedrin took over that position. And that was the position of Nossi. In the beginning, the position was not a hereditary position. And we find names of people unrelated. Yossi ben Yoezer, Shua ben Prachia, Shimon ben Shetach, Shemaiah of Avtalion, there were converts, until Hillel. From the time of Hillel on, the position of Nossi, of this patriarch, this highest position, which is the position of an internal and external position, internally in terms of the judicial legislative body, externally in terms of the executive body, was given already to a man that would carry it on for hundreds of years. And Hillel created a dynasty. The dynasty, as Chazal saw it, as the Talmud sees it, was alluded to in the blessing that was given to Yaakov, the blessing that was given that Jacob gave to Yehuda. Says to his son Judah, and he says, Lo Yosser Sheshevim Yehuda Mechoikik Mabein Raglov. The scepter shall not leave Yehuda, the position of political power, nor the lawgiver will not cease from issuing from him. Says the scepter, says refers, which refers to actually a position. The scepter is real power, the power to punish, is an allusion to a descendant of Yehuda, really descendants from the house of David, who had the position of Reish Galusa, the head of the exile, the exilarch, who were the political leaders in in the exile of the Jewish people in Babylon. But the position of the head of the Sanhedrin, which had this quasi-political power, is alluded to in this verse as B'nai Bonav Shel Hillel, the grandchildren, Hillel and his descendants. This blessing that Jacob gave to Yehuda was fulfilled in that family. At least there's an allusion to that. Actually, the Yerushalmi in Kilayim, the ninth parak of Kilayim, explains that Hillel really was a descendant on his father's side from the tribe of Binyamin. It was only from his mother's side that he was a descendant of Yehuda. But it was that family that created the dynasty. And there is... In the political climate that we live today, in the type of government we live, in the post-1776, post-Declaration of Independence, where we have a loathing for kings since George III, dynasts don't sell very well. But when we're dealing with inspired leadership, people of great, great spiritual stature, there's something to be said about a dynasty in the sense that it gives a sense of stability. That's why the English have, even though they've already stripped the crown of any political power, they still, the majority of Britons, still want the symbolic position of the crown. And they really says, even after all these scandals, they still have that sense of continuity. It gives them a sense of pride. Even though, on an elective basis, if they would start electing kings, perhaps they would choose somebody that's more fit. But there's something to be said about family and continuity. And here we have an issue which we've dealt with before. The idea of family versus intrinsic merit. Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel, the subject of tonight's lecture, certainly came from a very prestigious family and was a prestigious person in his own right, but not the most prestigious person. As we're going to see, he looked at himself as a disciple of the disciples of Rabbi Akiva. He looked at him as a disciple, and yet he was in the unusual position as being their superior, because he, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, had the position of patriarch. So he had the highest position, and he was over people that actually were greater in terms of scholarship than he. And it's a situation which is apt to create a certain friction, because the people that are under him are really more worthy of the position than he. He only has it because of family. And really it's that those dynamics which really color the incident that we're going to, which is the focus of tonight's lecture, the incident that we're going to learn of tonight. Before we go into that incident, I would first like to give you a background of the family of the family ties that Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel had to his forebears. The very first Mishnah in the Talmud, in the Mishnayos, is about the time when one says the Shema in the evening. And it brings a story, and this is in the first page of the lecture notes, in paragraph A. Rabban Gamliel, this is Rabban Shimon's father, said that one could say the Shema until the dawn comes up, until the crack of dawn. One had not said Shema before could say till the morning. His, Rabbi Gamliel's colleagues disagree. They maintain that it has to be said up until Chatzos, until midnight. Those you should say before that. Don't push it on. Once it happened that Rabbi Gamliel's sons came late from a wedding feast from Beis HaMishnah. And they says because of the festivities, and it was after midnight, they had not yet said it, recited the Shema of the evening. Says, what should they do? And he told them, this is his opinion, and he says even he explained that even those who take issue with him, this is how the Gemara explains, who said it should be said up until midnight, they only said it as this is the way it preferably should be said. But since midnight is past already, you still have even those who disagree with him maintain that it's still time. So if the dawn has not yet come up, you're required to recite the Shema. Here we find the idea of his sons in the plural. And it seems from the historians we know of two sons of Rabbi Gamliel. So Rabbi Chanina ben Gamliel and Rabban Shim ben Gamliel. The names are not stated, but at least they're alluded to here. They were students of his. They follow his directives in the lifetime of Rabbi Gamliel. And Rabbi Shim ben Gamliel in later life would recount various rulings that his father had ruled. As it says about the practice, described the practices of the house of his father, in terms of giving to non-Jewish cleaners before Shabbos, that they and their house would give it 3 days before to make sure that it was clean before Shabbos. An actual halacha, though, there's no need as long as it's given before Shabbos, and the non-Jewish cleaner is given the prerogative to do it anytime he wants. He doesn't have to do it on the Shabbos. It's fine. But he was saying that the practice of his father's home, though, was to make sure it was given and gave it enough time that it was done before Shabbos. Rabbi Shim ben Gamliel, in another instance, in terms of the davening of the prayers on Rosh Hashanah, again would say, would state from his memory, this was the practice in Yavna, where his father was the head of the Sanhedrin. In fact, the Yerushalmi has it, he would say, this is the way we did it in Yavna. He carried with him, he not only had the name of the son of Rabbi Gamliel, but actually was a student of his father's as well. He describes a fascinating incident just in terms of what an insight in the dynamics of the home. As you see on page 2, he describes, there were 1,000 pupils in my father's house. 500 studied Torah. This is the top paragraph of page 2. 500 studied Greek wisdom, because it was important for them. As we said, the position of Nasi, of the patriarch, was not just an internal judicial legislative position, it was an executive position. And they had to represent Jewish interests to the Roman government. It was important that they had people schooled in diplomacy, that they could speak with the Romans. Greek was the lingua franca of the Near East in the second century, in the first century of the Common Era. In fact, amongst the learned Romans, all the learned Romans studied Greek. And it was important for the Jews, at least be some Jews, be knowledgeable. Greek wisdom would be the highest level of the art of communication, rhetoric. And even though the Talmud makes a statement that there was a rabbinical prohibition of studying this wisdom, because they did not want Jews as a whole to study this, because of the fear that their position may be misused by the Romans, since they'll basically be close to the highest echelons of Roman government. They were afraid that these people would be, once they would get close to the Romans would use them against their Jewish brethren. So they didn't want any Jews basically being fit to be into diplomatic circles. However, there is an exception, though, with the house of Rabbi Gamliel. As people trained under his supervision, they made an allowance, because it was those people, and only those people, that they wanted to deal with the Roman government. Then there was another exception as well. One is not allowed. There was a unique haircut, which was common amongst the aristocracy of the Romans. This was not the traditional Jewish haircut. In fact, it was forbidden, from Darkei Amori. I mean, it was forbidden for the Jew to abandon the traditional way of cutting the hair and to imitate the Romans. But again, they made an exception for the house of Rabbi Gamliel. Because again, it was, as the Kesef Mishnah explains, this is one of the major commentaries on the Rambam, it was important to have these people for the safety of the welfare of the Jewish people as a whole. That you had people who were B'nai Torah, people who were infused with Torah, who were able to deal with the Roman government. And they made the allowance, not only the study of Greek wisdom in terms of Greek rhetoric, just to speak with them, but also they allowed them to look like them under certain circumstances. And he was, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, describing what the nobility of that house, and how many had studied. They both studied Torah. There was a group that studied, totally involved in Torah. Another group that was involved in diplomatic studies. But they were all killed. This whole group were killed in the Bar Kokhba's revolt. And he was bemoaning what had befallen, like the best and the brightest of Jewry fell, says at the sword of the Romans. Another very interesting insight into the relationship that Rabbi Shimon Gamliel had with his father is on paragraph E on page 2. The Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says, "I served my father my whole life." Now, it's evidently he had a very long, fulfilling relationship with his father. "But I didn't provide him with 1% of the service that Esav, who's the brother of Jacob, provided his father. So when I served my father, I served him in soiled garments, my regular day-to-day clothes." He says, "When Esav would serve his father, Jacob, he would put on royal garments." Esav knew what it is to honor a father. "And I, who basically devoted my life to my father, didn't reach his level." Which is interesting about it, since his humility, comparing himself as an underling, you know, compared to Esav. But it gives you a sense as well of the continuity of the house of Rabbi Gamliel. Now, this is not some orphan child of Rabbi Gamliel who just attains the position by virtue of biological descent. But here is a person who was trained under his father. He served him. He went to the schools or provided by his father. Had an intimate relationship with his father. So on one hand, here we have, which was the subject of this first section, we have the sense that Rabbi Shimon Gamliel is not just the biological heir to the position, but also he is the one who has been infused and trained by his father's house. We discussed before about this position of Nossi, of the patriarch, as a political position. The Romans were well aware of the power that the Nossi had. It wasn't just a matter of being the chief rabbi as a legal expert, but they looked at him as the king of the Jews. And that's why in various instances we find that the the government wanted to destroy any descendant of the house of David, in other words, the position of of these patriarchs, because they felt that if these people, the Nasi, would be destroyed, this is the patriarch would just be destroyed, says the Roman position will be all that much more firm. And we have, says in the bottom of page 2, paragraph A. This is taken from Eusebius, and one of his works is the Ecclesiastic History. This is the history of the early church. But in amongst the church history, there are different, at least, tidbits that we have of Jewish history. And it was said that Vespasian, it's interesting that I'll read with you, of the history, commanded all the family of David to be sought, that no one be left amongst the Jews who was of the royal stock. At least this is what the rumor that Eusebius was quoting. Eusebius was a non-Jew who was the bishop, the Christian Catholic bishop of Caesarea in the 4th century. And then in consequence, another violent persecution was raised against the Jews. One wonders about the historicity of this in light of the Talmudic tradition that he had promised. He had made a promise to Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai to spare the house of Rabban Gamliel. But on the other hand, we do know that Rabban Shimon, Rabban Gamliel's father, was the grandson, the great-grandson of Hillel, was killed by the Romans. And perhaps this is what it's alluding to, that despite the promise, or perhaps before the promise was given, that they had actually felt that it was important for them to destroy this position in order to cement their own position. But at least we have, Josephus is quoting a rumor, a tradition, that as early as the time of the destruction of the temple in the year 70, the Romans were bent on destroying the position. This is in paragraph B. We find Domitian, who was a son of Vespasian, again repeating this order that everyone of the line of David to be killed. On page 3, and in paragraph C, we have a tradition, and it's a question about the dating of this tradition. When Turnus Rufus, the wicked, plowed the temple, Rabban Gamliel was condemned to death. We know of a Turnus Rufus, who was the governor of Judea, who eventually was the one who killed Rabbi Akiva. And that would place Turnus Rufus in the time of Hadrian. We do know in the year of 121 of the Common Era that Hadrian wanted the place where the Beis Hamikdash stood, where the temple stood, that in its place a pagan temple to be built. According to Roman sources, this was the reason why the Bar Kokhba revolt came about. There are, of course, other reasons as well. But one of the reasons was that they wanted to take the place in the Beis Hamikdash and instead to build a pagan temple. Eventually, after Bar Kokhba was defeated, in the year 135, a pagan temple was erected on the site of the Beis Hamikdash. It could very well be, then, this is referring to the year 121. Rabban Gamliel then was still alive then, if this is this Turnus Rufus. The word Nasi in Hebrew is very similar to the Roman word, which is Nasi, which means nose. And a high officer came to the Beis Medrash, came to the study house, and wanted to warn Rabban Gamliel of the plot. And he said, this is the language of the Talmud, is Bal HaChoytim is Bakish, the man of the nose man is wanted. He wanted to allude to this without any other Romans hearing this Roman that he had divulged the plan to kill Rama Gamliel. So instead of calling Nosi, he called it, said a Latin word which is very similar, which is nosy. In other words, Rama Gamliel got the message, and he hid. And it was really because the officer committed suicide, and the Romans had a tradition that when a decree is put into effect, if one of those involved in the legislation of the decree dies, it's a bad omen, and the decree is annulled. This officer committed suicide to save Rabban Gamliel's life. But we find, in a sense, just from these sources, we see how the Romans felt the power of the position. When did Rav Shimon Gamliel become Nasi? When did this occur? I'd just like to touch upon the timeline that you're all given. I don't want to go through the whole timeline. We've covered this in previous lectures. Here you find the year 121. We just quoted. This was the time of the decrees of Hadrian. Bar Kokhba was defeated in 135. Rabbi Akiva's imprisonment and death, we're not sure, but we put the year 136 a year afterwards. Hadrian, the victor of Betar, died in the year 138. And Antoninus Pius became his successor. According to calculations which we've described in a previous class, eventually the great rabbis, not Rabban Shimon Gamliel though, came to Yavna for a convocation to come together to study. This was at that time that Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai made very biting remarks against the Roman government. His remarks were found out. He was condemned to death. He hid in a cave. For 12 years he hid in a cave until he was said he was a voice came out, Le Yoho Anovi came, and told him that Caesar had died. He's allowed to come out of the cave. Caesar died, Antoninus Pius died in the year 161. That would put the year the return to Yavna, where Rabbi Shimon made those remarks, near one, so the year 149. However, whilst Rabbi Shimon was condemned to death, Rabbi Yehuda Bar Eloi, which was the subject of last lecture, who made very complimentary remarks regarding the Romans, was put into a very high and prestigious position amongst the rabbis. And in fact, we suggested because that he was given that position, and the Romans therefore had confidence that the rabbis would not rebel because they had their man in charge. At that time, then we find shortly afterwards, we find Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel, who evidently was in hiding all this time. As we read from the previous citations, the Romans were very fearful of the power of the Nosi. And in fact, as Rabban Shimon said before, there were 1,000 pupils of Rabban Gamliel that were all killed by the Romans. He was the only one, he and a relative lived outside of Palestine, were the only ones that survived. Evidently, part of their vendetta of the Romans was to kill any trace of the family of Rabban Gamliel, or Shimon Gamliel. And therefore, for many years, he was in hiding. It was only after the Romans felt confident that that there wouldn't be a rebellion, and they had their man, Rabbi Yehuda, in place, that Rabban Shimon came out of hiding, and he took his position as head of the Sanhedrin. And here we find, again, this is now the emergence of Rabban Shimon. This was sometime after the year 149. The Sanhedrin moved from Yavna and came to Usha. There was an interim time they were in Usha. This was discussed in the last lecture, only for a short period of time. Usha is in the Galilee, Yavne is in the south in Judea. They went from Usha, and this was the study session. They finished one study session in Usha. The next study session was in Yavne. It's not clear how long they were in Yavne, but the study said it ended there. They resumed their studies in Usha, in the north. In Usha, in the Galilee, we find now Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel, subject of tonight's lecture, says, as the head of the Sanhedrin. And here we find, there's a quote here on paragraph A in page 3, section 3, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel as the Nossi. He was a person, though, it wasn't just a hereditary position, he was a person of great depth himself. And describing the sages of the period, Isi ben Yehuda describes him in terms of a well-stocked store full of fine merchandise. This is an officer of Inosin. He was a person of a tremendous body of knowledge. Often he quotes whenever he cites an opinion, it's an opinion which is based on much precedent from all that he had studied, both from his father and from the disciples of Rabbi Akiva. And in fact, only in three instances where he cites an opinion do we not rule like him. This is on the top of page 4. More Sanhedrin and Lamed Aleph Omed Aleph 31a. So here we find a person, just to give you the background, a person of prestigious family, a person of great stature himself, perhaps not of the stature of the other disciples of Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Meir, but surely in that league. And as we alluded to in the beginning of the lecture, he was a very modest person. In fact, here this is to touch upon it here in the first paragraph in page 4, we find, says, he is of the underline, so the Gemara Sanhedrin, Yud Aleph, Omed Aleph, and 11a. Says, he is called, the modest successors of later time, and as he is called in terms of the position of Nasi, he is considered a person of great modesty. On page 5, we quote a Gemara in Bava Metzia and Pei Dalet Amud Beis in 84b. He called himself, says, in relationship to another great man of the generation, Rabbi Shimon. He called Rabbi Shimon a lion. He, in contrast, he called himself just a fox. Was a much smaller person. His son, was Rabbi Yehuda Nossi, Rabbi, said that in our history we find three humble people. His father, B'nai Becerra, the family of Becerra who gave over, they had that position of Nossi, a patriarch of the Sanhedrin before Hillel. And when Hillel came and saw he was of a superior stature, they gave it over. They go over that position of power to the better man. Also a great sense of humility. People tend to hold on to power. And the third person was Yonason, the son of Shaul. This is the Jonathan, the son of David, who gave up, he was willing to give up his position of royalty to give it over to David, again, who he felt was his superior. In a subsequent discussion, the Gemara questions the level of the humility of the B'nai Becerra, that family who gave it to Hillel, and the humility of Yonason. But one thing is clear, the humility of Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel is beyond reproach. He was the most humble of his generation. He would often quote, as he felt they were his teachers, he would quote Rabbi Meir. This is in paragraph C, on page 5. He would quote his Rabbi Yossi, who considered him, he called him the great of the generation. So here we find, just to give you the background, a man of great family who not only was biologically part of that family, but who carried on that tradition because he was so close to his father and had studied under his father. A person of tremendous humility, a person of great stature in Torah. And it was important in that time, it was one of the most difficult times of Jewish history, to have a person who not only had tremendous character traits and the scholarship, but who had great leadership abilities to deal with one of the most difficult periods of our time. Rabbi Shimon, just to give you a sense of the time, at the end of the period of the Second Temple, a book was written called Megillas Tainis, the scroll of the fast days. These are actually days that are minor holidays. You're not allowed to fast because of all the special miracles that had occurred in those days. These are times of festivities. These are minor days. Chanukah is one that is mentioned in this Megillas Tainis. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel said, you know, we could write, the work stopped, there's a few additions, the work basically stopped at that time, in the time of the Second Temple. He says, we could write a whole book ourselves. He says, but what can we do? First of all, says, evidently we'd fill every day of the year. You know, it's like by the Chassidish Rebbe's, you know, with the Yortzeit. You know, on a Yortzeit of a Rebbe, you know, the anniversary of the death of a Rebbe, Chassidim don't fast. There are people who have a ledger of the days that great Rebbes died that you could avoid saying Tachanun. This is the additional prayer at the end of the Shemoneh Esrei that you fall on your face. Because just there's so many days. Which really then destroys the whole idea. You know, the whole idea if you have a day of festivity is that there are days you're not festive. Every day of the year says you're festive, you know, I mean, destroys the whole idea. He said, Rosh Hashanah says, you know, there's just too many days. We have too many miracles. We just can't write anymore. He says, another one is, he says, that we don't even have the depth of understanding of how many miracles are happening to us. We just can't write them down. On page 7, this one just a touch upon this. Again, it describes in his reign the times as that it seems to have been a holdover of Hadrian's decrees, that the Romans decreed that Jews couldn't keep Shabbos, they shouldn't circumcise their children, and they can't have relations. Their wives couldn't go to the mikveh, and they would have to have relations with their wives who would not be going to the mikveh. And he worked very hard to have these decrees annulled. And in fact, the decrees were annulled after Rabbi Shimon left the cave. He left the cave in the year 162, finally. 161 was another year. It was sometime after that time, in the reign of Marcus Aurelius, that this decree happened. On page 8, we can find another decree, a new decree, which is, then it had three elements here, that they were not allowed to study Torah. Again, they're not allowed to circumcise their sons, and they're required to violate Shabbos. And again, he was it was in his period, in his times, is that the decree was annulled. These were very difficult times. Just this gives you a background of this. When he died, he says, when Shimon died, he says, it says, Olu gavoy v'robotsaurus. Locusts came up and troubles increased. And there's a question, when locusts came up, does it mean literally there was a plague of locusts? Or does it mean figuratively because, again, there was increased problems were by the Romans? And which would indicate probably the year 169, because we know that there was a whole rebellion. There was a whole problem of a particularly harsh Roman governor in Syria during that time. We don't have any facts about how it impacted on Judea, but we know that we dealt with very, very difficult people at the helm. And we would assume that this was approximately during that time. It was important in times of stress to be a strong central leadership. And that sets, I just want to put the background here of the following incident. As we said before, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel was the Nasi, was the patriarch. It was a position that he inherited from his father. There were other positions in the Sanhedrin. One was Av Beis Din, the head of the Beis Din, which was the position just a notch lower than the Nasi. It was an internal position. And that was given to Rabbi Nosson. Rabbi Nosson was a man of great stature. He was involved in the creation of the Mishnah that we're going to in a subsequent lecture. He was the son of the Exilarch, the Reish Galusa, in Bavel and Babylon. He was a man from a great family, of great stature. He had the position below him. The third position, Chochem, the elder statesman, the one that they would seek advice, was Rabbi Meir, the most brilliant of his generation. This is the first lecture of this newest series. They were all originally given the same honors. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel decided at a time when Rabbi Nosson and Rabbi Meir were absent from the yeshiva, from the Sanhedrin, that there should be a hierarchy of honors. That Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, in all probability, I'm speculating, for him to be effective in his role as the Nasi, and there should be a sense of a clear position, as the highest position, it was important for him to be given honors above the rest, even though as his personal stature he was not of their level. He was aware of it because of his humility. He always quoted them in a superior position, but he felt because of his political position it was important that he be vested higher honors. So he instituted a hierarchy of honors, that when he entered the yeshiva, the whole yeshiva should stand up for him and not sit down until he had come to his place on top. As Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Nosson, who was the next position, just the outer rows, in other words, would stand up. And as the outside row, there'd be rows, but in the aisle, in terms of the aisle that he was walking, the ones on the outer rows would stand up. Again, they would stand up until he sat down in his position. Rabbi Meir, who's the third position lower, not all would stand up, but the people in the outer rows next to him would stand up, and as soon as he passed, they would sit down. So people would alternately stand up and sit down as he was passing. When Rabbi Nosson and Rabbi Meir had come back from their absence and saw that they were not treated with the same respect, they were quite annoyed. They were not asked. And they felt that since they were superior to him in the level of their scholarship, that he had abused his position, and he was not worthy of that position. And they plotted, they had made a plot against him. The last tractate in the Mishnah is Uktzin. Uktzin deals with laws regarding the laws of Tumah, of ritual impurity, as it affects not food, but the ukits, the handle, in other words, the wooden protrusion, that you hold, let's say, a pear or an apple. It's a yad, it's a means of, you can hold it and transport it and pick it up. Tumah affects not only fruit, but the yad, the ukits, in other words, the wooden protrusion of fruit. And there's three chapters that deal with the subject. It's a very arcane subject. And they were certain, Evidently, many years had passed since the yeshiva had studied it. Rabbi Noson and Rabbi Meir were certain that Rabbi Shimon was not familiar with it. So they had this, their plan was they decided to begin studies of Uktzin. And of course, so Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, his position again was external, internal. So he would be the one to lead the discussions of this area. And since he would be totally unprepared, he would be embarrassed. And they would, at that position, says when he would be shown that he is not clearly their equal, that they would press the issue that he is not fit for the position because they felt he had misused the position. And Rabbi Noson would then take the position of Nossi, of the patriarch, that now had been vacated because of this coup. And Rabbi Meir would be lifted to the position of Av Beis Din. One of the members, Rabbi Yaakov, was aware of the plot, wanted to make Rabbi Shimon Gamliel aware of this without telling him directly. So in front of his window, he started studying the laws of Uktzin out loud. And Rabbi Shimon says, what is he studying Uktzin for? He says, something afoot. So Rabbi Shimon started reviewing on his own this area of Uktzin, this arcane area. So then the next day, when he asked, is anyone there studying Uktzin, he was well prepared. And he realized, of course, what had occurred. And because of that, he issued a ruling that they be disbarred, basically Rabbi Noson, Rabbi Meir, be totally thrown out of the yeshiva. You know, Tayid gets a chanetze, you know what I mean? They were not... So what did they do? They were outside the yeshiva. They weren't let in, right? But they stuck in slips of paper with questions. What do you say to this question? Nobody inside could answer, including Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. So they didn't know it, so they wrote down the answers. And it became ridiculous after a while. So Rabbi Yossi said, you know what I mean? What do we say? The Torah is outside, not inside. How can we not let them in? So Rabbi Shimon says, okay, we'll let them in, but we're going to put a penalty. There'll be a price. That from now on, anything that's quoted will not be attributed to their name directly. So therefore, any statement that will be repeated that Rabbi Noson says, Rabbi Noson will not be given credit, but just Yesh Omer, there are those who say. And when Rabbi Meir will be making a statement, we will not quote him by name, but we will say Acherim Omrim, others say. That's what they did. And this was the rest of the yeshiva evidently agreed with this, and this is what had occurred. In fact, it says later on, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, studying with his father, and he said that it was he was going to the he was quoting something. In the name of others, say. He's asking, you know, who are those others? You keep on quoting those others. Who is the others? So he says, Roshim will answer, says like this. These are men who wish to uproot your dignity and the dignity of your father's house. This is Roshim Lil, who was the most modest of his generation. And yet he felt, he says, that this is not only a personal slight, a slight on the whole, on all his fathers, you know, his forebears as well. Eventually, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi prevailed upon him. He says, you know, he is long gone, and it's over with, you know, so we could give him credit. So finally, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel said that we'll say, some say Rabbi Meir said. In other words, not giving him, like it said in the name of Rabbi Meir, not giving him total credit. But it's just interesting to find here we're dealing with people of the highest integrity, highest spirituality, highest intellectual ability. But the struggle was similar to a struggle that we had with Rabban Shimon Gamliel's father, Rabban Gamliel, a very similar situation, where we have the question of the importance of maintaining the dynasty because of all the prestige it gives to the Sanhedrin as a whole and makes them all the more effective to deal with the outside world versus the idea of having a meritocracy of the best people should have the position. When Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Nosson felt Rabbi Shimon Gamliel had abused his position, they felt enough is enough. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, of course, prevailed. But to understand these people, we have to understand that both were dealing with very, very lofty people, and in their eyes, they were motivated by the highest motivation. I'd just like to end off. We quote here, and you can look at yourself on pages 11 and 12, the various quotations from Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. Well, time doesn't allow right now to, then you can look at it yourself. But I'd just like to listen to the last quote here. There's a question if monies were collected for the burial needs of someone, and the money was collected, it came out, was more than was needed for the actual burial needs, and those for the shrouds and hiring the grave diggers. What should the unused portion of the money be used? Rabbi Nosson maintained that they're to be used for a monument. That's for a gravestone, a monument, or a more elaborate monument on the, you know, so to give honor to the deceased. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel made the statement is, for righteous people, we don't need monuments. Their words, and this is teachers of Torah, are their true memorial. They live on. We don't need a physical edifice to preserve their memory. Their teachings, the inspiration we have from them, is their greatest memorial. I don't know where Rabbi Shimon Gamliel is buried. But certainly, says that which we've studied from him, that which he's inspired generations upon generations of students of the Talmud, is the greatest memory, of course, for he and his colleagues. Okay, are there any questions? Yes.
Was the Nasi a voting member of the Sanhedrin?
Yes. The Nasi was a voting member of the Sanhedrin. In fact, one of the proofs. So, I mean, again, this is what Rav Isaac HaLevi brings. There's a Mishnah in Zvochim, in Yud Aleph, and, that describes as 11b, says that describes as about a certain decision that was made with when the 72 members of the Sanhedrin made this decision. So he speaks about not 71, but 72. And here Isaac HaLevi derives the 72nd is the Nasi.
Did the Sanhedrin originally empower them to mean that it should only be the Hillel's family where they elected
that?
Why did Hillel's family take over?
We don't have the whys, we don't know. We do know there's a general rule in positions of political power. In other words, that children have the first right of succession if they are fit for the position. But it was a blessing. It was a blessing that they had because again in terms of the other ones, none of them had children that were fit to have that thing. Yeah. Yes.
During the time of Rabbi Gamliel,
Again, it's not entirely clear about when the, there's a question as to when it occurred. Let's say for arguments, not for this, that it occurred in the year 90 of the Common Era. Whereas this occurred in the year 160 of the Common Era. Just to give you a sense of the historical time frame. Yes. Right. Evidently, again, we're dealing with times that it was important for him to, I guess, as a representative of the Jewish people, I don't know. That's not clear. It's not clear. Did it because they were missing, or it was a position that he felt that it had to be done, and they for the absence and for something which is beyond his control. So that is really left with a question mark. In issues as this, where there's only one source, we're really only left with the information that we're given, and there are very often a lot of questions that are really unanswered, and we can only speculate. So it's just not clear. Yeah. Did he do it because they were absent, or did he do it because they've been absent? Just happened to have been. They wouldn't have been absent. He would have implemented it as well. It's not clear. It's not clear. Okay, good enough. Good enough.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237.